Physical inactivity is a major risk factor for the development of cardiometabolic diseases like heart disease, cancer, strokes, and diabetes. But so is being overweight. And since obesity and inactivity go together, which causes death more often? Obesity or not getting enough exercise? Stand by. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Being inactive is actually twice as lethal as being obese. But what if you can check both boxes? Perhaps you reminisce about being fit and slim in high school or on your wedding day. But with marriage, kids, and a career, your priorities changed, but unfortunately so did your physical profile. Aileka is a busy science executive, a wife, a mother, but she found that the status quo was no longer acceptable.
I have four kids, so, you know, you wake up, you get the kids going, and you get going on your day working. I'm a director of resource management for a consulting firm, SSA & Company, so that becomes very demanding, and then the kids come home, and you got to get all that going. So trying to get a workout in was tough. I try to go in the mornings to the gym, but just the motivation wasn't necessarily always there.
Daddy, hold pizza.
Is your smoothie good?
You're eating what the kids are eating. And a lot of times what I found is that whatever they left on their plate, I would end up eating that, you know, because I didn't want to waste the food. I would also, have my meal later because I've got to get them fed, and then now I'm eating. So now I'm eating even later, which, you know, causes the food to stay on my body even longer. We definitely did pizza at least once a week, which most families do. There was always, you know, spaghetti, lasagna, shells, different things like that. And then usually dessert. I had ice cream or brownies or something like that. My husband, number one, is 180 pounds and 6'1". So, you know, he was born fit, right? So he would always, you know, take the kids outside to play. And I always wanted to go, but I really couldn't. I'd be so tired. You know, if I got out there, I really couldn't run around with them. I couldn't do the different things that I wanted to do as a mom. And it was tough, you know. I'll never forget one day I was at Target with Zachariah. I was at Target with him and he'd run off, you know, and I couldn't catch him just because I was so overweight and out of breath and just, you know, 323 pounds. I couldn't keep up. And someone else had to get my child for me. And you know, that's just a tough, you know, something really tough to face. That's a tough kind of blow when you can't really keep up with your family at all.
That's tough when you have a busy young family. On today's show, our guest has been an Everest expedition physician. He's been a base physician in Antarctica and a missionary doctor in Papua New Guinea. We have our very own session with Sean, who has helped Aileka toward her goal. We'll find out what to eat when working out, but first, the news. In the headlines today, exercise that gives back sevenfold, intense exercise impacts intestines, and teens need more action. Ever wondered which exercise pays back the most? Researchers calculate that on average, every hour of running is associated with 7 hours of longer life, no matter what age you become a runner. So if you run all through adulthood, you end up with an extra 3 years of life. And when it comes to premature death, runners have a 30% reduced risk. Non-runners who walk, swim, or bike have a 12% reduced risk compared with inactive people. And runners have a 45 to 70% lower risk of dying from heart attack or stroke and a 30 to 50% lower risk of dying from cancer. Researchers looked at data from several large, long-term studies that tracked physical activity in thousands of adults. So these are actually loose associations, not cause and effect. However, if you can, then run. Excessive strenuous exercise may lead to gut damage. Australian researchers reviewed 8 studies looking at exercise-induced gastrointestinal syndrome. After 2 hours of continuous endurance exercise at 60% of your maximum intensity, it seems that there is a risk of gut injury and impaired function. As exercise intensity and duration increase, so does the risk of intestinal injury, leaky gut, and the release of endotoxins from the gut into the bloodstream. The stomach and small intestine empty more slowly, and there is malabsorption of nutrients. Heat stress, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications, and dehydration only make matters worse. A low FODMAP diet in the lead-up to heavy training or racing may reduce symptoms. Heading into their 20s, young Americans are getting as much physical activity as 60-year-olds, according to a Baltimore, Maryland study. Researchers analyzed accelerometer data from 12,500 people to see how much and how intense physical activities were in each of 5 age groups: children, teens, young adults, midlife, and older adults. From age 6 to 19, as age increased, activity decreased, so that a 19-year-old will typically be as sedentary as a 60-year-old. Fortunately, young adults' physical activity levels increase with age till they stabilize during midlife, when most exercise is actually done in the mornings. As people reach 60 years of age, activity levels drop off again, though women were better at men than being physically active. With the diabetes epidemic in full swing, why not have fun getting fit no matter our age? I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. Today's guest is Dr. Ralph Bavard, sports medicine physician who was a presenter at the American College of Lifestyle Medicine annual meeting in Naples, Florida, where we spoke with him. In his work in health promotion, I asked him if we should think and talk in terms of being physically active or in terms of having exercise.
I think for the most part when people talk about physical activity, that just suggests more movement, whereas exercise implies more of a regimented or a systematic form of exercise. I really prefer fitness because it really gets at the outcomes as opposed to the process of what we're doing. And I think that's where we need to go ultimately.
So what's the definition of fitness? How do you define that?
Sure. Fitness obviously can be defined different ways by different people, but I think the key components of it are cardiorespiratory capacity or status measured by best by VO2, and then a component of body composition, body leanness and or adiposity, and how that interplays with and allows high level of fitness. There are also muscular strength, muscular endurance, and proprioceptive flexibility, balance components that a lot of people would roll in there too. So
now, some people would say that you can be fat and fit, but you're suggesting that fitness does actually reflect your body shape or your percentage of fat.
Right, and I think the misconception that has occurred in the whole idea of fit and fat is because it's based largely on definitions that have been imposed by the use of BMI, which is, I feel, largely invalid as a metric, and that we should. And I think that if we discontinue using BMI and instead use something like DEXA to truly measure percent body fatness, then we're able to make a more measured assessment of that.
Mm-hmm. Although DEXA is a lot, it's expensive and it's hard to do on a person-by-person basis, so I guess we sort of do the lazy thing and we use body mass index because it's just a function of height and weight. But for an athlete like yourself, it really doesn't, it's not reflective.
Well, actually, I'll be 64 this month, and I'm a recreational athlete, but I share the views of people like Walter Bortz that, for example, that VO2 is a global measure of fitness and one that we should apply to everybody. And I think that knowledge of actual and precise body composition falls into that realm as well. So I think that from the standpoint of accuracy and precision, that it's important for us to evolve our use of technology.
So if you have access to technology, see how you can apply it to fitness. Find your baseline and track your progress. Now, can you relate to this?
Here, try this.
Oh, thanks. Hey, I saw this health guru on TV eating cardboard.
Cardboard?
Yeah, you know all this health food, it tastes like cardboard.
Very little health food tastes like cardboard. That's a huge myth.
Oh, come on. You know that people eat health food to stay healthy, not because it tastes good.
That's not true. But even if it was, wouldn't it be worth it?
Hey, can I have another piece of
that? Sure.
No, it wouldn't be worth it. I'd rather die young and happy than old and miserable.
Well, me too. But you can have your cake and eat it too.
Cake? Cake? I don't see any cake. Where is it at?
Oh, you've got a one-track mind. I mean, you can die old and happy by eating healthy and tasty food.
Like what?
Well, you're enjoying what I just gave you.
You mean I'm eating health food right now?
You are.
Oh, you're... What is it?
It's dried banana. No sugar, no preservatives.
Well, actually, to be honest with you, it tastes very, very good.
Well, there you go. So try a variety of healthy foods. Doctor's orders.
Perhaps you're thinking about what to eat and drink before, during, and after your exercise. Research shows that if you avoid eating before exercise and you're fasting, you'll burn more fat during the workout and maybe for the next 24 hours. However, you'll have burned just as much fat by the end of the week, whether you ate before working out or not. Also, when you're using fat as fuel for your workout, you'll build up more ketoacidosis, and that can be harmful to the kidneys and contribute to fatigue and dizziness, which you don't want when you're working out. So it's better to eat when it suits you, and it would be a pity to miss the workout because you'd already eaten breakfast and you thought you shouldn't have. So I will add, though, that intense exercise after a heavy meal, it's never comfortable and it slows digestion. If you're eating before you work out, you want to base the amount of food you're going to eat on how hard you plan to exercise. On the other hand, a 10-minute walk, gentle walk after eating aids digestion and helps to control sugars and bring them down. Just be sure that you get a more intense exercise session in at a different time of the day. Now, if you're doing endurance exercise, you need to load up on carbs 1 to 4 hours ahead of time. That will improve your endurance. Then you'll need to eat something along the way as well. Even more importantly, though, is hydration. Dehydration quickly leads to exhaustion and a rise in body temperature. So hydrate well before you go out and carry water with you. For food, I want you to think about long-lasting carbohydrates, a little healthy fat, and some protein. So you might be thinking a bowl of rice or oatmeal, those nice whole grains, with perhaps some fruit and yogurt, milk, or some whole wheat toast, peanut butter, banana, all before you head out. And then if you plan to exercise for 1 to 2.5 hours, aim to eat 30 to 60 grams of carbs during your exercise session. Now for that, you might think about an apple that has 25 grams, a large banana will have 30, a cup of juice, 33, a granola bar, 20 to 30. Now for shorter stints of exercise, always carry water with you, but you won't need food. Just plan to drink about 1 glass of water per every 20 minutes of exercise. And sports drinks. You know, they're heavily promoted in gyms, but if you're doing moderate intensity exercise, even for an hour, you really won't need the additional electrolytes and carbohydrates that are found in sports drinks. If you're working out at high intensity for an hour or at moderate intensity for an hour and a half or more, then those extra electrolytes might just come in handy. Otherwise, plain water should be your best go-to. And remember, it's better for the planet and for your wallet to use tap water rather than bottled water. That is, if you live in a country where tap water is safe. And if you're wanting to lose weight, you really don't want those extra calories in the sports drink anyway. After a lighter workout, eat a well-balanced meal within 2 to 3 hours and drink enough fluid, remember, to replace your losses. If you've had a long or intense exercise session, chow down on protein and carbs within 20 to 60 minutes. That will aid muscle recovery. Don't make the mistake that most people do in consuming excess amounts of protein. You know, after a workout, you want to aim for about 15 to 25 grams of protein. That might be half a cup of granola, that's 8 grams, a cup of soy milk would be 6 grams, a couple of tablespoons of nuts is 3 grams, 3 tablespoons of flaxseed, 4 grams, banana and berries, a couple of grams. So in recovering from exercise, remember the 3 R's. You want to rehydrate with fluid, you want to refuel with some carbs, let's throw in some berries, and perhaps a banana. There's our carbs, and then we want to repair with protein. So rehydrate, refuel, and repair. So we've got some protein in our milk, and let's put some nice flaxseed in there, a little extra fat there. And you know, if we're doing that, a smoothie becomes a perfect routine. And let's blend that up. And if you want to get over some muscle soreness, then add some cherry juice. And pretty soon you have got the perfect post-workout smoothie. Mm-mm. Cheers. Oh, that's good. Weighing in at over 300 pounds following the birth of their little girl, Elika determined to be a good role model to help her little girl grow up with a healthy body image. After losing 25 pounds going to the gym with friends, the motivation dried up. Then she bumped into Nadia, the wife of Sean, Go Healthy for Good's very own personal trainer. He runs a boot camp called Hard Body Outdoor Fitness.
Nadia had mentioned Sean and Hard Body Outdoor Fitness. And she asked me to join, and I said, I don't know about that. They look like they're doing some hard stuff.
Here, squat down.
And she was like, just try it.
Walk it back. You got 2 rounds of that to get the 20, and then use the curb. You have your 15 dips.
So Sean texted us and said, hey, come on, you know, try it for a couple weeks and see how you like it. And so we went, and we just never looked back. We've been going ever since. That was last November. And I remember telling Sean that by December, I wanted to be able to do a true burpee, you know? And he reminded me, you know, in December, that look, now I'm actually doing burpee, you know? When we first started, I was the last one in everything. If we were jogging, I was in the back, because I was probably like walking and jogging, or mostly walking. And then if we were doing push-ups, anything we were doing, I was usually toward the back of the crowd. And he was like, you know, he's like, just stop and take note of what's happening right now. And I'm like, well, what's happening? You know, I don't know what we're talking about. And he's like, you know, you're in the middle. He's like, there's a few people ahead of you, and there's several people behind you. And you're in the middle of the pack. That's a huge gain. And just kind of highlighting those gains have been really important for me, because it keeps you motivated and keeps you going, you know?
Let's go, start with that back row. Down, yep. Count it out. Make sure you let them work. Yes.
Now it just seems normal to go to class to wake up at 4:45, you know, in the morning. I know it's crazy. It seems rather normal to do it now, because we've been doing it for so long, and also, class has not necessarily gotten easier, but there's more things that I can do. Prior to going on this journey, I had really bad knees. I ended up with plantar fasciitis, so my feet, like major pain in my feet, my knees, my back bothering me constantly. Since I've lost the weight, you know, my knees, I don't have nearly as much pain in my knees. And then also my plantar fasciitis is getting a little better as well. That also, I had to, you know, not only lose weight, but do a lot of stretching and different things too to get rid of that.
The many benefits of exercise and fitness, which, if you have a physically active job, will come with the territory. However, for the rest of us, fitness takes time and effort. Today's guest, Dr. Ralph Bavard, is a master swimmer and Nordic skier. Here he explains why everyday fitness matters for us all.
There's huge value for the individual in terms of hopefully improved longevity and possibility of joy. I think, you know, it matters for our loved ones because it hopefully allows us to be here longer. It matters for our employer because it reduces absenteeism and presenteeism and increases productivity. It matters for society and the community because we're a healthier people. And I think that has huge value.
Right. So if we tease that out, when you say it's healthier, what sort of diseases are impacted? What are some of the diseases, I should say, that are impacted by fitness or lack of fitness?
Sure. I think the Healthy People 2000 and 2010 and 2020 initiatives by our government have helped to look at some of those metrics, and various groups, the American Heart Association and other groups like that, WHO, CDC, have really helped to identify and link the risks of being unfit, and they primarily center on cardiac disease, type 2 diabetes, various types of cancer, really all of the comorbid conditions that we look at can be significantly impacted by being more healthy.
And probably also some of the physical things like back pain, which most of us will suffer from by the time we're 70.
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that we see more and more in particularly our, for example, in the workplace and occupational injury, probably 75% of the issues are musculoskeletal. And one of the distinctions that we make is what I call insufficiency versus overload injuries. An overload injury is abnormal forces applied to a normal system. You drive your car into a tree, break your tibia or femur. But insufficiency injuries are normal forces applied to an abnormal system. Traditionally, that was pathologic fractures, metastatic fractures. But now
so
we're
where
seeing
the cancer's eaten the bone and it breaks.
Right.
Yep.
But now we're seeing that in people who, because of their lack of fitness, poor disuse, muscle atrophy, are unable to do the everyday jobs of their employment. I would hate to be an employer in this current time, largely because of that.
Wow. I didn't realize that was important.
I had a 300-pound individual who collapsed their own chair, fell on the ground, injured, bruised their backside, and had a low back work injury that was filed and had to be honored. So we're seeing more and more things of that nature, and that's a little bit extreme. But
it represents what could be out there, and 300-pound people are not uncommon anymore. So
very common in America.
That's right. So how do we were talking about measuring, how do we accurately assess fitness if we really want to know? Because we are curious creatures, we like to measure and do things to ourselves. So how do we assess our fitness?
Traditionally, different tools that are things that are still currently used are health risk assessments. People can do a lot of vital signs, height and weight, and BMI has unfortunately become a surrogate that's used and associated with a lot of measures of ill health. But I think, you know, again, it suffers from what the CDC has recognized. Dr. Flagel wrote an article and discussed the term obesity paradox, because they found that actually the hazard risk for individuals in the overweight category was less than it was in the supposedly normals. And so, again, I think as a measure, that's not as good. Again, the ones that I would like to see us evolve more have to do with using DEXA scans to assess body composition, and also doing either VO2 tests of some sort, and there are good metrics and measures now that allow us to do that online in less than 5 minutes as a calculation using regression analysis studies that the Scandinavians have done.
Okay, so how do you just run us through very briefly how you'd measure VO2?
Sure. There's a group from Trondheim, Norway called the CERG, which is Cardiac Exercise Research Group. And they studied a very large group of over 5,000 individuals age 18 to 90, and then did VO2 max testing on them where they had masks and the whole shebang, and then worked backwards. And so they were able to compile measures that they could use with individuals to predict or calculate their VO2 based on these shared characteristics.
So you wouldn't have to go through the whole shebang where you're wearing the masks and you're all hooked up and,
exactly.
and exercising away. Okay, yep. You get dropped into their chart
yep.
to see
yep.
where you sit.
And it's actually very, very accurate. I've done it with probably 50 different people, friends who've actually had VO2 studies, and it's within about 3%, so it's quite
wow.
accurate. And I think the huge value is that it allows us to have a validation tool that if we did do a baseline study, we could then use something like that at intervals. It's interesting that the metrics that they are most important are waist circumference, resting heart rate, max heart rate, things of that nature. I've actually gone through and done it over and over online and tried to cheat by lying about my frequency, duration, and intensity of exercise. And you can get by a little bit, but by and large it's very good because you have these actual physical measures.
But you have to be honest about how often and how intensely
yeah.
you exercise.
And I think if you're doing it with a caregiver who can assist you, then it that's a little bit of a protective measure. So
go to ntnu.edu/CERG and use the fitness calculator to find your own VO2 max. Be ready to join Sean and I for a short workout after the break, but first, here's something to think about. The story is told of a man who was crippled. He had four great friends, and they dearly wanted to help him walk, and they knew of a way. His name was Jesus. One day, they grabbed a hammock, loaded up their crippled friend, and followed the crowd. Emphasis on crowd, because when they reached Jesus, they couldn't actually get to him. So they had a bright idea. They ran upstairs, tore a hole in the roof, and lowered their friend down until he lay at Jesus' feet. You know the rest of the story. Jesus took pity on their friend, assured him that his sins were forgiven, and healed him. With peace and joy, he jumped up and became one of Jesus' biggest fans. His life forever changed. You see, well-chosen friends are God's way of taking care of us. His four friends enabled him to be healthy and whole, and each of us can influence friends and family to up their game when it comes to health. Even if you're not willing to do it for yourself, perhaps you do it for someone else. So find a buddy to exercise with. Bring someone to Jesus. Invite a friend to a weight loss challenge. Post a healthy recipe. And be a positive agent for change today.
Back. If you're in the kitchen, in the lounge, in your office, it's time to turn it into a gym because Sean's here.
Hey, everywhere is a gym.
I'll bet your office is a gym half
it
the
is.
Time.
It is. Yeah, it's yeah. a playground. It's a gym. It's a you name it. So today we have a resistant band and some dumbbells. Okay, very simple tools, but I'm going to show you some great exercises. You ever had anyone ask you how do you get rid of that?
Yeah.
No.
The hellos goodbyes.
The hellos goodbyes. I like that. Well, I'm going to show you how to get rid of the hellos and goodbyes, okay? And a great way to tone up the body, okay? Because you just got to take your time, and I think when people see it, they'll understand how to say goodbye to the goodbyes, right? Okay,
so what are we going to do?
So, now, if you're in a gym, a park, or anything, go on the treadmill for about 30 seconds, for a minute. Just run, have some fun, do some jumping jacks, just have some fun. All right, but what I want you to do is take your dumbbells, and you could take the resistant band just to kind of show the equivalent of what I'm gonna do with the dumbbells, okay? Now, let's get rid of the goodbyes, right? So what we're gonna do is we're gonna squat down a little bit, engage the core. Elbows are gonna be up here, and all I want you to do, even with the resistance band, is kick it back. But what I want you to do is pause here.
Oh.
Oh yeah.
Oh.
You're saying goodbye to the goodbyes.
Oh.
Right, bring it back here.
Yeah, I think I might put kick my it feet back. Closer together here.
Yes. So that was a good point. Keep it going for a second. To make it a little bit easier, you keep your feet together. To make it a little bit tougher, you spread your feet just a little bit wider, which makes that a little bit tougher, okay?
Yeah.
But to get rid of the goodbyes, the tricep right here, right? You have to pause at the top. So give me four of them with the pause at the top, all the way. Yes. One, two, come on. Three, one more, and hold it. You need to work it here. Keep it tight. Three, two, and one. Nice. You saying goodbye?
I hope you joined me. I'd hate to think I was.
You got to come off the couch on this one. You have to. All right. So the other part is if you work the back, it's good to work the front as well. So what I like to do are hammer curls. And you can do that with a resistant band where your palms are facing your thighs. Eyes are forward. And all you're doing is coming up. Come back. Now, all these exercises, you want to inhale through your nose, exhale through your mouth, get oxygen in, get the carbon dioxide out.
And we want to exhale as we work that
exactly,
muscle.
Exactly.
Inhale as we relax it.
And guess what? You'd be surprised how much more muscular endurance you get when you can give your muscles the oxygen, right? And then last but not least, one of my favorite exercises, and you may not be able to do that with the resistant band, but all I want you to do is do an air squat, okay? So you can drop the resistant band, come all the way down, and back up. So you work the tricep, you work the bicep, and now you're gonna work the powerhouse, which is the quads. But when you get to the top, just like any rep, you wanna try with these? These say 10s, but they're really...
I don't think I do.
No, just try it.
Come on, try it. Wanna try it?
Remember, challenge, right? There it is. Yes, three more. Three, come on, two, one more. Hold it down there, come up nice and slow. And you could even add a pulse, do a little pulse like this. And come up, yes. Challenge the muscle, change it up. If you're normally doing the same thing over and over again, guess what? You gotta change it up.
Yes, you do.
You gotta have some fun. So there you go. Getting rid of the goodbyes, keeping the arms nice and tight since everyone sees the arms, and keeping the quads nice and challenged because this is where you burn a lot of calories. The big muscle group, quadricep. Mm, okay, and then
right.
You wanna cool it down.
We do.
You
what
do.
Are we gonna do?
All right, what I want you to do is get your balance. Feet here. Three, two, and one. Switch. Three, two, and one. Good job.
Great, thanks, Sean.
You're welcome.
What could you do with an extra 5 years? Earn a degree, visit the 7 modern wonders of the world, or kiss your great-grandchild's cheek? You can do a lot in 5 years. 5 years is the difference that researchers found in the life expectancy between vegetarian and non-vegetarian Adventists. The Adventist Health Study found that vegetarians lived 5 years longer than their non-vegetarian counterparts. Adopting a vegetarian diet could add 5 years to your life and is another ageless advantage.
Now it's time to answer your questions. Someone called and asked, I had ovarian cancer stage 4. What should I be eating? I've had chemo and I'm not on any medications at the moment. I really recommend in this situation that you eat about 70% of your food raw. That's raw fruits, raw vegetables, nuts, not roasted but raw nuts. Avoid processed foods completely, especially oils and sugars. Just get rid of all of those out of your diet. Try to use plenty of herbs in your cooking and the spice turmeric in your meals because they have powerful antioxidant properties. Eat moderately of the cooked foods. You'll have whole grains and whole legumes. And just when you're eating the nuts, don't have too much nuts. Here's our next question. I'm 63. I've been depressed since 10 years old. I am vegetarian and wondered what else I could do. Is there a way to get hold of Dr. Nedley? Watch our series on depression with Dr. Nedley. We've done five programs with him, and if you want help from him, then attend the Residential Depression Recovery Program. You can call 580-226-8007 for the Depression Recovery Program, or look up online drnatalie.com. Here's another question. This is from Angela. I'm 66 years old, slim, non-smoker with osteoporosis that my doctor wants to treat with Forteo injections. I have declined it and started calcium, vitamin D, and walking. Are there any other suggestions? Well, you say you're slim. That puts you at increased risk of osteoporosis. So when you're out walking, you might want to buy a weighted vest. It has a bit of lead in it. It's quite heavy. That increases your body weight, puts more pressure through your legs, and that will help to strengthen your bones. Eat plenty of leafy green veggies for calcium, magnesium, and potassium. All of those are important, not just the calcium in isolation. Tofu, soy milk, soy beans, edamame, they're all good sources of soy isoflavones. And you can also take isoflavones in pill form for added bone strength. Hormones can be helpful. Estrogen is not an option at your age, but progesterone can help to increase bone density. And there is less of the negative side effects with progesterone. Just bear in mind that Forteo is a synthetic form of the parathyroid hormone that your body naturally makes. And what it does is it increases calcium absorption from the diet. It is a fairly new drug. We don't have long-term safety studies with it. But if your next bone scan shows continuing loss of bone density, even though you're having a good diet and exercise, you might consider using the Forteo or another drug or hormone. Now, remember, you can send us your questions by Facebook, text, or phone. You can contact us through our website and like us on Facebook to become part of our Go Healthy for Good community. Now, let's see what's for dinner today. Onions are the third most consumed vegetable in the United States. They are so versatile, great for breakfast, casseroles, barbecues, and even holiday dinners. They give flavor, color, and texture to a wide variety of dishes and cuisines. 87% of the United States onion crop are yellow. They're a great, reliable standby for cooking almost anything. 8% of the crops are red onions, and with their wonderful flavor and color, it's a good choice for roasting or for fresh. White onions make up just 5% of the US onion crop, and they're used in salads, white sauces, and they're the traditional onion for classical Mexican cuisine. And because they're one of the top 10 antioxidant veggies, be sure to have some most days. Bon appetit. As a keen cross-country skier, today's guest, Dr. Ralph Bavard, has been involved in researching Berkeys. Let's start by asking, what is a Berkey?
The American Birkebeiner is a cross-country ski race in northern Wisconsin that's held annually. And it's, I think the first one was 1971 or 73. I've done 20, and so I've cut back to the half race now. But it's a tremendous, joyful cross-country ski jaunt of about 50 kilometers through the northwoods of Wisconsin that happens every February.
Wow, it'd be cold.
Well, it is, but you know, once you get moving, you warm up pretty quickly.
Yeah. So how many people participate in this?
Annually, it is approximately 10,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and the number of people who've done the race over the years is, I think, about 25,000 now. So it's a good group of people.
Now, you've done some research on this group. Tell us about that. Why you did it? What you were looking for?
Right. I was a second author on a paper. One of my good colleagues and friends, Paul Anderson, who was then in a fellowship at the Mayo Clinic in prevention, was the lead author. And the survey went out, and we had responses from about 5,500 people, skiers. And the things that that were found in terms of social metrics and influences on an individual to participate in this cohort group of physically active.
So you were really asking the question, why do it?
Yeah.
Why
get out of
there?
Bed? Why drive to Wisconsin? Why fly in from all over the country to do a race on a Saturday in the middle of
winter?
Yeah, in February.
Yes.
And the thing that we found that was really interesting, and I think intuitive we knew a lot of this, was that the greatest factor that compelled people was the social side. It was the coming together, being with family, with friends, who in many cases had gotten them started in skiing. But there were a lot of very interesting metrics, I think, too, that came from the study.
So what was it that, like, the social factor? Tease that out a little bit for us and tell us about these other things that you
A lot of it had simply to do with calling a friend up and saying, are we going to go skiing this weekend? So there was sort of a coupled planning. Even though people acknowledge skiing together with friends or opponents multiple times per week, they did also ski independently. So there is an autonomic or an independent aspect too that.
So what you saw was people set a goal to come to the Berkey race, mm-hmm. but then they had to get themselves fit and mm-hmm. maintain fitness before that. So they would train on their own, but also go out with friends. That's what you're saying. So that was the autonomy and the socialization.
Yeah, and I think it's the having created a goal or an objective that gives people an impetus to an incentive to do that. So. The very interesting things were that of this group of 5,500 people, only 3% had BMIs over 30, compared to our population of over 30% have being at BMIs over 30.
Yeah.
Only 3% were smokers. I think it was 93% indicated they did not have depression. 99% felt that they were more fit than than other people.
And I'm sure they were.
Well, may or may not. 86% consumed vegetables and fruit daily. So they were really meeting a lot of the lifestyle guidelines that this organization, champions.
Which came first? Was it that they were already healthy? Could you tell even? Were they already healthy and this was just adding something to their, another arrow to their quiver? Or was it that this goal changed the way they lived life in order to reach that goal? Did you know?
I think it's both. I think that people who, there are a number of people who, live this way because it's important for them and it's a lifestyle that they've grown up with. For many other people, it's one that they see and come to admire, and it becomes part of their life. And I think we see the same thing in marathoning or other endurance races like that. And there are a number of big running studies that have also helped to demonstrate that sort of camaraderie and shared enthusiasm that propels people to remain vigorously active throughout their life.
So there's hope for all of us. We can all get off the couch as couch potatoes mm-hmm. and actually start to set bigger and bigger goals and maybe get drawn into this.
Absolutely, and I think the thing that that really is the most wonderful about masters sports in general is that it is very recreational. And the enthusiasm is not to win. It's not to be having laurels, but it's to participate. And the pageantry of the Birkebeiner is just an amazing experience. Masters swimming, masters running, all of these sports, really cycling, rowing, we call the silent sports. And they're by and large low impact, but they're designed to embrace and bring people into the fold and allow people to be active and see physical activity as a joyful way to use your and honor your body.
Especially since your body was gifted you by your creator. Stand by for more from Dr. Pavard after the break. Ilika was 323 pounds at her heaviest, and when she couldn't keep up with her three-year-old in the store, she knew it was time for a change. 4 days a week, she now attends Sean's boot camp, And with 90 pounds off in just over a year, she's within reach of her goal weight of 140 pounds. And here's what else has changed.
I've always been a bigger person. I mean, I was born 10 pounds. So I was never, you know, called thin in my life. But having four kids back to back and really picking up, you know, a substantial amount of weight, I didn't feel like me after a while. You know, it's just, you know, you can't walk around, you can't put on the same clothes, you can't really buy clothes in the store. Now it's kind of nice to be able to just buy things and you don't even have to try them on because you know they fit. You know, it feels good to be able to just go and run around and play with my kids. The other day we were playing the Justice League and I was Wonder Woman, and we're running from room to room, you know, flying, you know, different things. And it's stuff that I couldn't do, you know, a year ago. You know, so I mean, it's a huge change for me. It's something that my oldest son, John, he's 9 now. One of the things that he said to me the other day was one of those Facebook quizzes that you do, and you can have your kid, you ask your child, you know, questions that, you know, what's mommy's name? How old is mommy? You know, things like that. So he did know my age, though my 6-year-old said that I was 14, and I was proud of that. Like, thanks, buddy. But when they asked, you know, what's mommy's favorite thing to do, and they said exercise. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, like that's a huge change. Before they probably would have said watch TV. That's actually another thing that's changed. I don't watch TV anymore. I don't have time. You know, I literally used to watch probably 3 to 4 hours of TV a day, you know? So I'd get off of work, I'd have the kids going, I'd be cooking and have the TV on, or I'd be, you know, doing different things and the TV's always on, which showed them that, you know, the TV was something that we did all the time. Now, I don't really watch TV. The TV's not on, I forget that it's there. I would tell someone trying to go through a change to think about what motivates them. You know, if you're a mom, think about your children and what you want to show them and where you want to be for them, or dad even, you know, same thing. Or even other things that may motivate you, just being able to walk up the stairs without getting tired, you know? And so the first thing I would say to do is get up and go, you know, try it. Don't make excuses and build a blockage before you actually take your steps, you know? Because a lot, I noticed that I did that a lot. I'd either make excuses or come up with reasons why I couldn't instead of the reasons why I could, you know? I could get up and go for a walk, so why wasn't I, you know? And I would say make changes with food too, because what I've noticed is that you don't drop as much weight if you just do the gym. You have to, like, food is like 80% of it.
She's absolutely right. You need changes in food as well as in fitness, and both require determination. Even though I've been active all my life, on cold, dark winter mornings, I struggle to stick with it. So here are some tips on stickability from today's guest, Dr. Ralph Bivard.
You know, I think a lot of it just has to do with, again, that social element. And so having friends and family who are enthused and find joy and happiness in doing something hopefully becomes infectious. But I think clearly there are a lot of psychological issues too. I know that people talk about some of the adverse childhood experiences that sometimes can make these decisions difficult for people, some of the dietary issues. And I think that it's particularly difficult for children who at a young age develop a problem with weight or don't have the role modeling to be physically active. And so I think that while I like to say that everyone can or should be active and athletic, that we do have to recognize that there are socioeconomic things that come into play that make it very difficult, more difficult for some people than others.
Doesn't make it impossible, but it is a significant barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now, when we go to the doctor, we get our vitals measured, you know, our pulse and our blood pressure and all of those things. But you talk about the exercise vital sign. So explain that.
Yeah, this is something that's been really advocated by a lot of caregivers. Bob Salas from Kaiser Permanente was the lead through the American College of Sports Medicine for the Exercises Medicine Initiative. And Liz Joy is the current president of ACSM, and she's been very active with Bob in trying to get the exercise vital sign incorporated into the electronic medical record so that when caregivers see a patient, they're able to inquire about an individual's physical activity in terms of the type of activity, the duration, the intensity, and
the frequency.
Frequency of, of participation.
And so that would become as important as all your other vital signs? And always measured each visit sort
of
thing?
At least a conversation point. And I think one of the things we recognize that when we don't talk about things, that patients don't think about them as much. So at least inquiring about that. And for the most part, patients do appreciate that. They want us to say, you know, consider nicking off a few pounds or being a little bit more active or cutting down on your cigarette use. And it's not obviously going to impact everybody, and it's not going to achieve 100% results, but if we don't make an effort, certainly we're not going to get as close as we want.
Right, and we're doing our patients a disservice.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, we're so often given this blanket warning, check with your doctor before you do exercise.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's two messages come through. One, that exercise is not safe because mm-hmm. you have to check mm-hmm. with your doctor first, but does that apply to everybody?
Well,
does it stand as a barrier? Because a lot of guys don't want to go and see the doctor for anything.
Sure, sure.
And so they're not going to come.
Yeah. I think for the most part that rarely are people not benefited by being active, and seldom do they have things that really will prevent them from being active in some way.
So you're saying it might actually be unsafe not to exercise,
right? Absolutely, yeah. And that's one thing that we absolutely know is that there are so many more comorbid conditions and deaths that occur in people who are sedentary and don't who are overweight and don't exercise, as opposed to those who are out there running marathons and doing things like that. So
it's unsafe not to.
Right.
Really.
We have 750,000 people a year die in the United States due to smoking, overweight, and sedentarism. And that's of the 2.5 million that that pass away annually. The number who actually die from sporting type events is probably less than 100. So it's very, very, there's a huge discrepancy in terms of risk. There has been recently some literature suggesting that extreme endurance exercises that they call EEE may have some tendency toward cardiac disease, but I think that the vast majority of the literature that looks at that dispels that, or at the very least the examples that we have in the literature is very heavily weighted to the side of suggesting that there's for the most part, a linear relationship between physical activity and reduced mortality that's pretty consistent for the vast majority of people.
Now, you mentioned exercise as medicine. So if you were to do an exercise prescription, what would that look like? What would you include in that prescription?
Sure. My preference is that people set a goal of trying to be active about 5 hours a week, ideally. And that can be sort of any type of activity. And again, I think the key thing is for people to find something they like to do. I encourage women to join a social type of group, whether it's Pilates or yoga, not doing hand weights, which can put a lot of kinetic chain stressors on the limbs. But a rowing machine is you can't go wrong with that. It's low, safe, close to the ground. It's a great tool for rehab with knee replacements, shoulders, hips, things like that. And it's one of the few things for women that will pull their shoulders back and help reduce the tendency toward a kyphosis that we unfortunately see in so many elderly.
And how often?
If a person can be active 5 hours a week, that's about 240 hours per year, and I like to keep track of it that way. You don't have to exercise an hour 5 days a week or break it down in that way, and I think that freeing yourself up to know that you can do 3 hours on the weekend and then a couple of shorter workouts on the weekday when you're busy at work can make that happen.
Mm, so that you add that flexibility in.
Most people in general who say they don't have time to exercise, on average, Americans watch about 20 to 22 hours of TV a week. And so 5 hours of physical activity is less than 3% of your lifetime. And I think that's the greatest investment that you can make.
Are you ready to make the greatest of investments? Spend less than 3% of your time maintaining fitness in exchange for health, joy, and bigger. 5 hours a week might sound like a lot, but you'll add more years to your life and more life to your years. Aleka's story demonstrates how weight will normalize, mood will lift, and energy will be boosted. Good choices will be easier to make in all areas of your life. You'll be able to keep up with your kids or even your grandkids, and disease will be dispelled. By involving friends or family, you'll be creating memories, bonding, and being an inspiration to others. And like Aleka, in setting goals and working out together, you're more likely to stick to it. So make a start today. Go to the fitness calculator on ntnu.edu/CERG for your baseline VO2 max, then aim for improvement. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.